From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley, hosting today from Columbia, South Carolina, ahead of Saturday's presidential primary.
And I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. And today, the World Health Organization warned the seven countries that have reported their first cases of COVID-19 in the past 24 hours to act aggressively now. Also today, Japan ordered all public schools to close until April. And health officials in California say someone is hospitalized there who could be the first person in this country to come down with COVID-19 without coming into contact with someone else infected. But yesterday, President Trump contradicted his own health experts, saying he didn't believe an outbreak was inevitable here. And the president also contradicted facts presented by CNN chief medical correspondent Sanjay Gupta, who joins us now. Sanjay, hi.
Hi. Thanks, Robin.
And well, thank you, because our goal here is to just get accurate information out. So let's start with that exchange you had with President Trump. It was about death rates from COVID-19 as compared to the flu. Earlier in his press conference, the president was, seemed to be surprised about how many people died from the flu. Let's listen to you and him.
Flu has a fatality ratio of about 0.1%.
Correct.
This has a fatality ratio somewhere between 2-3%.
We don't know exactly, based on the numbers so far. And the flu is higher than that. The flu is much higher than that.
There's more people who get the flu, but this is spreading, or it's going to spread maybe within communities. That's the expectation. Does that worry you? Because that seems to be what worries the American
people. No, because we're ready for it.
So, Sanjay Gupta, what we want to know is more about those percentages you were giving. The president seemed to be discounting what you see as more serious. What were you meaning about 0.1% fatalities with the flu, 2-3% with the numbers so far with COVID-19?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at these pathogens, Robin, there's two things public health officials pay attention to. How easily does it transmit, and how deadly is it? I think the president, in some ways, was drawing this analogy between coronavirus and flu earlier on, saying, look, this is contagious like flu. And I think he was saying that to sort of, trying to lay people's fears. Flu is something that we know. The point that I was wanting to make sure he understood was that with flu, the fatality ratio is 0.1%. So 0.1% of people who get flu do die from this. Because so many people get the flu around the world, that's why there are so many deaths. With coronavirus, the fatality ratio is around 2%. So it's transmissible like flu, thankfully not the same numbers yet. But with a 2% fatality ratio, that makes it 20 times more lethal. Mm. So the transmissibility similar, lethality, at least according to the best data that we have coming out of China, 20 times higher. And I think that's why public health officials are really paying attention to this.
Mm. Well, was it, or how concerning was it that President Trump seemed to resist that? And he, the fact is people have been saying, oh, but the more people die from the flu.
That's right. Yeah. I think what was concerning a little bit was that we learned that the president just found out right before that press conference from his team that flu does kill tens of thousands of people a year. He did not seem to know that. I think the other thing that was surprising was that when I said that flu fatality ratio is 0.1%, at first he agreed, and then he said, actually, flu is much, much higher, he was saying, seeming to imply that it was much higher than coronavirus, which it just isn't, not according to the data that we're seeing so far, not with what we know right now.
Well, with what we know right now, coupled with these headlines that we've been talking about, the fact that we have somebody who has been infected who apparently hasn't come in contact with anybody recently returned from China or showing symptoms. And we know that people can be carrying the virus and not have any symptoms. A woman visited a family. The entire family got sick. She did not.
That's right.
What other concerns do you have? We're reading that Facebook, for instance, is trying to get rid of ads claiming to have a cure for COVID-19. What do you want people to know?
I think there's a couple of things. So there's 60 patients total. 45 came from the cruise ship. 14 patients were either travel patients from China or close contacts of those patients who were known to be infected. This 15th patient hadn't traveled to these areas and hadn't had any contact with someone that he knew was infected. So that basically means the virus is likely to be spreading now within a community, has gained a foothold within a community. And I should point out again that public health officials have been anticipating this for some time.
Well, so Sanjay, I just want to ask you, the other news today is that the CDC says they've cleared up this logjam that was preventing test kits from getting out. But it sounds like that's not the biggest problem if, in fact, you would not have necessarily tested someone if you didn't know they, you know, if they hadn't come in contact with anybody.
Yes, I think that's true, Robin. But I will say that the criteria for being tested in the United States, I think there is a fair argument to be made that has been too stringent. Mm-hmm. In Korea, for example, they've been testing thousands of patients a day. We haven't even tested 1,000 patients in several weeks in this country. Mm. So right now in the United States, we have a wonderful public health system, but there's only 10 places you can be tested in addition to the CDC. That's probably not enough. And as a result, they've probably missed lots of people who were at risk.
Yeah. Sanjay Gupta, we'd love to have you back for your informed thoughts on this. CNN Chief Medical Correspondent Sanjay Gupta, thanks so much.
Anytime, Robin. Thank you.
President Trump is scheduled to be here in South Carolina tomorrow before the Democratic presidential primary on Saturday, and the state's senior senator is expected to be by his side. Republican Lindsey Graham does not have a challenger in the primary, but for the first time since he was elected to the Senate in 2003, he is facing a formidable opponent in the general election, and that's Democrat Jamie Harrison. South Carolina Public Radio's Victoria Hansen reports.
Along with President Trump, Lindsey Graham may be one of the country's more polarizing political figures. The Republican senator has become well known for lashing out at Democrats, especially after the president's impeachment. Here's Graham on Fox News.
They're on a crusade to destroy this man, and they don't care what they destroy in the process of trying to destroy Donald Trump. I do care.
Graham's support of Trump looms large as he seeks a fourth term, and polls on his reelection bid are mixed. The most recent, from Change Research and the Post and Courier, a Charleston newspaper, shows the senator may be vulnerable, clinging to a 2 percentage point lead over challenger Jamie Harrison, the likely Democratic candidate. We caught up with Harrison campaigning at a coffee shop just outside of Charleston.
Let me tell you a little bit about me so that you know, because I know some of you are here because you want to get rid of Lindsey. I understand that.
The 44-year-old grew up in rural South Carolina, but rose from poverty to become the first in his family to go to college. He graduated from Yale, worked for Congressman Jim Clyburn, and is now with the Democratic National Committee. Harrison says there's no obstacle he can't overcome.
People are now telling me, well, you can't beat Lindsey Graham, right? Watch me.
Harrison says he's proof the American dream still exists, but he believes more people need opportunities. They're tired, he says, of divisive politics.
We have to help people rebuild trust, but we also have to help people get hope again.
His message resonates with Sherry Augustine, who recently moved to South Carolina from New York.
He just brought me to tears. It's the first time I've heard him speak, and it just really hit my heart.
While Harrison grinds away at a coffee shop, Graham's campaign has yet to reschedule appearances. They say he had to cancel because of the impeachment trial. They also did not respond to our repeated request for an interview with the senator. Brian Hicks, a newspaper columnist who has long covered South Carolina politics, isn't surprised.
I think he campaigns on cable news.
Hicks says he hears from readers who complain Graham doesn't show up as much in South Carolina anymore. But he's quick to point out, those who reach out are often independent, more moderate voters. Voters Graham once appealed to when he wasn't so attached to Trump. Hicks says diehard Republicans have also had a change of heart.
All of a sudden, people who used to hate Lindsey are now rewriting history and saying we've always loved Lindsey.
Yeah, it's not going to be a race at the end of the day. I mean, Senator Graham will be reelected, and he's going to be reelected by quite a bit.
That's Joe Jackson with the South Carolina Republican Party. He says Graham raised nearly $4 million in the final quarter of last year, slightly more than Harrison, who Jackson says gets his backing from out of state.
It's D.C. money. It's Hollywood money. He's really excited more of the liberal base outside of the state.
Jackson insists Graham is accessible. He's just a busy U.S. senator. And his relationship with the president, he says, is beneficial. But Gibbs Knotts isn't so sure.
Make no mistake, South Carolina is a red state, and, you know, really, we shouldn't even be talking about a senator, a Republican senator being in trouble. But, you know, Lindsey Graham has made this hard right turn.
Knotts is a political scientist at the College of Charleston. He says the political landscape of South Carolina is rapidly changing, with more newcomers moving in. It's not unheard of anymore for a Democrat to be elected. Mark Sanford's old congressional seat recently turned blue. And Knott says having an African-American candidate like Harrison on the ballot could bring out more black voters in November to help whoever is at the top of the Democrats' ticket.
I do think that the state's African-American voters, and again, that's about 30% of the voting age population, will be very excited.
But this is a state that hasn't elected a Democrat to the U.S. Senate in more than 20 years, a state Trump won by nearly 15 percentage points.
You know, Graham is making a bet that it helps him enough with his base. He has enough of a cushion in the general election in South Carolina to survive. But that's why we have elections. So we'll see what happens in November.
For Here and Now, I'm Victoria Hansen in Charleston.
You might know Nick Kroll from his very raunchy animated show on Netflix, Big Mouth.
Are you the puberty fairy?
The puberty fairy? I'm the hormone monster. I'm not a fairy.
Well, now he's starring as a romantic lead in a movie set at the Olympics. Actor and comedian Nick Kroll, next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
We're here in South Carolina for the primary election this Saturday. And one of the first places we paid a visit to was Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston. It's where, in 2015, a white supremacist walked into a Bible study and killed 9 members of the congregation. Almost all of the presidential candidates have been there to pay their respects, and the tragedy was mentioned several times during this week's Democratic debate. A lot has happened since the shooting, but other things haven't. People thought it was a no-brainer to enact a hate crime law, but nearly 5 years later, lawmakers are still trying to get one passed. South Carolina is one of only 4 states in the country without any hate crime laws. Democratic State Representative Beth Bernstein is the latest lawmaker to try.
As a state, we came together from the terrible tragedy that happened at Mother Emanuel. And I think it's just important that we recognize that we need to stand up against this type of horrible behavior.
The shooter, Dylan Roof, was sentenced to death on 33 counts of federal hate crimes. But Bernstein wants legislation that would punish people on the state level for any type of crime motivated by hate because of someone's religion, race, gender, or sexual orientation. As the only woman of Jewish faith in the South Carolina legislature, Bernstein says this bill is also personal.
In this time that we're experiencing, there's an uptick in anti-Semitic events all across this nation. There are an uptick of all sorts of racially motivated violence. And I think this is the time that we need to stand up and say, this is wrong, and we're not going to tolerate it.
For several years, Charleston area Democratic Representative Wendell Gilliard has also pushed for hate crime legislation. His measure would have made it a felony to commit an offense with the intent to intimidate, assault, or threaten a person based on their identity, like race or religion. Representative Gilliard's bill, along with several other variations from other lawmakers, have died in the legislature. Republican Senator Greg Hembree is one of the lawmakers who is against the idea. He thinks while they're meant to protect certain people, hate crime laws are actually discriminating against others.
My concern is any statute that discriminates against one group versus another. In other words, saying that because of the color of your skin or because of your gender or because of your religious beliefs, your rights as a victim are superior to other people's rights is problematic.
Senator Hembree believes this, even though Federal Bureau of Investigation data show that in 2018, hate crimes against marginalized people were at a 16-year high. Hembree also argues that hate crime laws do not deter someone from committing a crime, and he thinks the laws are more symbolic than anything else.
I quite frankly feel like this sort of legislation is sort of feel-good legislation that you can kind of check the box and say, well, we passed that. You know, now we have a hate crimes law. I don't think you'll see it enforced very much, quite frankly, almost never, because trying to prove the mindset of the defendant is virtually impossible.
But Mother Emanuel AME pastor Eric S. E. Manning says for his congregation,
a hate crime law is about more than enforcement. It's also about acknowledgement.
To them, it's not necessarily a feel-good type of legislation. It is just something to say, I hear your pain, I understand your struggle, and though I can't necessarily undo what was done, I'm going to add my voice to say never again, not now, not ever.
The lack of action from South Carolina lawmakers is a window into a larger societal problem for those still grappling with what happened here at Mother Emanuel.
I struggle with the fact whether if it happened to me, if I could be as forgiving as these members.
I met Regina Thomas in front of the church, praying. She traveled here from New Jersey for this week's Democratic debate. She's visited the church 9 times in 5 years. And she's been thinking about a lot, like, how will lawmakers stand up against hate? And how can she learn from members of Mother Emanuel AME to have compassion for those who hate enough to kill?
Some of my pain is, God, I want to get there. And I respect so much the foundation that was laid of those that went Bible study. It goes to a lot of the teaching. But this congregation lived what they learned. Totally biblical.
Mother Emanuel AME is now part shrine, part tourist attraction in Charleston. People like Thomas still stop by to pay their respects, and the church is still healing. No longer can visitors easily walk in. There is a sophisticated security system in place, with cameras focused on just about every inch of this 203-year-old church. Pastor Manning says it's the new normal.
We are learning how to worship and still make sure that we are mindful about security. And it's one that I will say is a delicate dance. You want to always ensure that people who are coming to worship don't have to think about the cameras, don't have to think about security, which we are doing our best to ensure that they do not think about.
I'm Chris Singleton. I'm 23 years old. I'm a father, husband, inspirational speaker, and a believer.
That last title, believer, Chris Singleton says it's a work in progress, a practice he takes on every day. Singleton's mother, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, was one of the 9 killed by Dylan Roof. Chris became an adult in an instant at 18 years old with a responsibility of caring for his younger siblings. And while Singleton's mom never got to see him become the father, husband, and the positive force he is now, it's the practice of forgiveness rooted in his faith that keeps him going.
I believe so many people view forgiveness as letting the other person off the hook. And I was reading something. It was a pretty cool quote. I'm not sure who it was by, but it said, forgiveness is setting a prisoner free only to realize later that you were the prisoner yourself. And I think that's so powerful because we think that we're letting the other person off the hook by forgiving. But in actuality, we're just freeing ourselves from that constant feeling of revenge.
Singleton often thinks about a quote his mother would say, love is stronger than hate. Like he said, he's a believer, which means he also believes that one day South Carolina will join the 46 other states with hate crime laws on the books.
Well, first and foremost, I think, as a state, we are behind in some things, but I think we're trying to move forward. And it may take time. I've realized that. I'm a young guy, but I realize some things do take time.
Bernstein's hate crime bill is now making its way through the legislature.
It's going to be an uphill battle, but yeah. I continue to reach out to law enforcement and to the business community to really put some pressure on some of those members who think that, you know, the time is not now for hate crime legislation. And I would refute that and say the time is absolutely now.
The legacy of that terrible shooting is just one of the many issues voters are thinking about ahead of Saturday's primary. Another is climate change. In 2019, the city of Charleston flooded almost once every 5 days. And officials here are already planning for a 2 to 3 foot sea level rise over the next 50 years.
My name is Betty Barnwell. Our address is Flood Street. The number one issue is flooding.
We met Bonwell sitting on her porch talking to some of her neighbors. She lives in public housing near Gadsden Creek, a strip of tidal wetland carved out of a former landfill on the northwest edge of the Charleston Peninsula.
I couldn't say why, because it always floods back here. You get the heavy rain, yes, it's going to flood. Sometimes it floods so bad you can swim in back here. Not over here, but, you know, on the concrete out there. But it's not good, really. It's really not good. I mean, heavy flood. Nobody cleans it up. Nobody cleans it up, darling. Mm-mm.
Dealing with this regular flooding is a way of life for Bonwell. And as she gets older, health care is also something she's been thinking a lot about. She has coverage, but there are a lot of folks around her without it. It's one of the reasons she's got her eye on Senator Bernie Sanders.
I like Sanders. I just had the feel anytime he talk, I can feel it like he will help us with medical. And a lot of people out here now need medical, like Medicare. I get Medicare. I get both of them. So people older than me, you know, don't get it.
According to a recent CBS poll, 42% of South Carolinians say health care is their number one concern. South Carolina does not have expanded Medicaid, which leaves many low-income residents without coverage. As we chat, Bonwell looks across the street, where some pools of water are forming after the light rain. And she brings up another problem plaguing the city, those who have housing and those who don't.
And right now, a lot of people out here right now don't have a place to stay. Yeah, they got shelter, but then it's a lot of more people, a lot of people here. You go see some of them sleeping up under the bridge and all that, you know, it's... Mm-mm. But you just gotta... I like people get help.
For years, the number of homeless people on the street in Charleston was going down. But last year, the city saw an uptick. All of this weighs heavy on Bonwell. So, of course, with the primary election just days away, she's thinking about her vote and what will count most.
What I want for America, I want to help each other, help people, you know, help us. Not only me, I mean, help everyone. I'm not going by color and all that. Just help all of us.
67 million dollars. That's the price tag the US women's soccer team has set for settling its equal pay lawsuit against the US Soccer Federation. The gender discrimination case generated a lot of attention last year. You remember fans chanting equal pay as the American women won their second straight World Cup. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at slate.com. Hi Mike.
Hello.
So could the two sides be further apart? The players want nearly 67 million, the National Soccer Federation wants the case dismissed. Discuss.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess they could ask for $167 million. there is a huge gap. It is not unusual, especially in the opening salvo of a lawsuit like this, to ask for the maximum or ask for an eye-opening amount. And this is even the women's lawyers have said that the women's team generated $85 million from 2015 through 2019. And that's in somewhat dispute by the men. But if you just take that, we're saying, I mean, they're acknowledging we want more from them than the entire women's team makes in a year.
Yeah, well, U.S. Soccer is using the words of Megan Rapinoe, one of the star players, in its argument to dismiss. She used the phrase apples and oranges, and they're throwing it back at her. Explain that.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the lawsuit that uses these little rhetorical phrases. And I'm not a legal expert, but it seems to me that in the past when I've covered stories like that, they don't really add up to a lot because this is Megan Rapinoe trying to say that the men's game is different from the women's game. In many ways it is, right? In fundamental ways it isn't. By the same token, the lawyers for the women's side have quoted past presidents of the soccer federation saying things like... they play under the same rules and they play on the same field, trying to equate the men and the women. So, right. You know, that's, again, a little bit of posturing and rhetoric.
Right. She said the jobs were apples and oranges and now, you know, they're saying yes, so you should be paid less. Well, most likely the case is going to go to trial. The judge set a May date for that to begin just ahead of the Summer Olympics that July. Our Peter O'Dowd spoke with Rapinoe in December and asked if that trial would be a distraction.
Oh, I mean, it's certainly a distraction in some sense. Depositions will have to be taken. We've gone through mediation. We've gone through countless hours of preparation and phone calls and research and proposals and all of it. So, yeah, it's certainly a distraction. Hopefully not too much. I feel like, again, we are pretty skilled in balancing many things at once. That's part of what it means to be on the U.S. Women's National Team.
I'm confident she can balance many things at once, like, you know, 10 soccer balls. But what's at stake here, just in the minute we have?
You know what's interesting about that quote? Whenever you ask an athlete, is it going to be a distraction, they always say no. But there's Megan Rapinoe saying yes. So why? One, she's honest. I mean, it will be a little bit of a distraction. But two, there is public sentiment in play, and she's trying to. This may not be one in the courts. It may be one in the court. Sorry, a public opinion cliche. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, you know, if they're saying to the women's fans, look, you really want the team not paying us, getting us in the way of your athletes having glory, that could do more than any legal arguments put forth. What will happen? There was an interesting thing that was unearthed in the collective bargaining agreement, which we haven't seen beforehand. The players can't strike. So I have seen some reporting that, oh, maybe they won't even play in the Olympics. They would be violating the CBA if they were to go on strike. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear Megan Rapinoe say that, but I just want to underline that point.
Here's another cliche. Stay tuned. Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst, also host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
After gaining the endorsement of Congressman Jim Clyburn, former Vice President Joe Biden is banking on South Carolina to deliver a win for him in Saturday's Democratic primary. And Biden is no stranger to voters here. He made that clear in the Democratic debate earlier this week.
I've been coming here for years and years, creating jobs here, making sure that the port, for example, that employs 1 in 11 people. We put $500 million in our administration just into this county. We've created jobs for people.
That port he just mentioned ties into where I met my next guest. Jamie Lovegrove is a political reporter for The Post and Courier, and I spoke to him at a location in Charleston that is not only economically significant to South Carolina, but it's also one source of Biden's popularity in this state.
So we are at the U.S. Custom House in Charleston, which historically has been used as a place to organize a lot of the trade that has come through the Charleston port, which is a huge part of South Carolina's economy to this day. It always has been. It's, of course, been a checkered past. I mean, before the Civil War, this was a place where, you know, thousands of slaves were transported to the United States. But it has also since then become a huge part of the economy. And part of the reason why it is significant this week is because it's one example of why Joe Biden is so much more popular in South Carolina than he is in some other states. You know, he worked very closely with Fritz Hollings, who was a longtime Democratic senator from South Carolina, as well as Strom Thurmond, the longtime Republican senator, in the Senate. They were all very close friends. And Joe Biden often worked with Hollings to increase funding for the Charleston port. Again, a huge part of the Charleston economy. There are a lot of folks in Charleston who have not forgotten the help that he delivered for them over the years, including in the business community. And so, you know, there are a lot of reasons why Biden has experience and popularity in South Carolina, but that is one of them.
Yeah. You wrote that this is a very consequential week for Biden.
Yeah.
He actually sees this as, in a way, coming home
yes.
to those that he supported for so many years, decades even. But you also write that, well, people have been very supportive. Right now, they're also not sure.
Yeah.
And why are you hearing that from folks? What are they saying?
My sense is people, for one, have seen what's happened in some of the other states. And while they don't generally like to take cues from whiter states in Iowa and New Hampshire and somewhat more diverse in Nevada, but still, you know, I think 10% of the electorate in Nevada was African-American voters, and folks here like to think of themselves as independent thinkers. But it does affect you when you see a candidate struggling there and you start to question the central argument of his campaign, which is that he's the most electable. You know, at a certain point, voters start saying, well, if you're the most electable, why aren't you winning elections? And, you know, I think that some of his performances on the stump have been erratic. You know, there are times when you see the Joe Biden that everyone has known for many decades. And there are times when, you know, he seems like he is sort of meandering and it's sort of a little unclear where he's going sometimes. And so I think some voters that I've talked to have gone to some of those campaign events and come away a little unsure. And as a result, they started to look towards some of the other candidates, particularly Tom Steyer, who has not really made much of a ripple in any other state other than South Carolina, but he's been very successful here. He has spent millions and millions of dollars on television ads and mailers in South Carolina. What his pitch has been is, you know, if you look at 2016, Donald Trump did very well against establishment politicians in the Republican primary, folks who had been elected officials for many years, and then he beat an establishment politician in Hillary Clinton, someone who had a huge amount of experience as Secretary of State and as a senator. So, you know, his argument to folks is, if we're going to beat Donald Trump, we need someone who comes from the same world that he does, which is business, and can talk about why he believes that his business record and his record on the economy is not all that he makes it out to be. So some people are receptive to that, and that has made a bit of an indent into Biden's support.
I want to go back to something that you said about Biden's performance on the stage.
Yeah.
One issue that he is very strong on is about his relationship with the community.
Yes.
And with the African American community specifically. Yeah. And there are deep roots here in that too. Mm-hmm. Not only in the support that he has pushed for financially within the Senate, but also just on a personal level.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, so he has been not just, as you say, funding issues like the Charleston port here, but he has been coming to South Carolina for decades. As I say, Fritz Hollings was a very close friend of his, and he introduced him to a lot of the movers and shakers in South Carolina politics who have remained very close to him for years. That includes elected officials. It also includes a lot of, you know, very senior pastors at a lot of African-American churches around South Carolina, which have huge political influence. He's been very close to Jim Clyburn, who is by far the most influential Democrat in South Carolina.
Let me ask you about Clyburn, Representative Clyburn. He is thought of as someone who is hugely influential,
yes.
But he's also part of the establishment.
That's true.
And so when you talk about Steyer and Steyer's push here, have you seen in any way a breaking of that among maybe younger voters or those who have seen Biden's performance and maybe are feeling unsure?
There has been a fascinating generational split that I've noticed among voters of all races, but particularly among African-American voters. And I think that one of the specific ways that I've seen it is I was talking to Congressman Clyburn on Sunday, and you know, he was sort of laying out his thinking as he's preparing to make his endorsement. And he said what he is worried about as he looks at this primary is he's worried about a repeat of 1972, when George McGovern became the nominee, a very progressive figure, but also somewhat divisive within the Democratic Party. Not all the Democratic Party was behind him, went on to a landslide loss, lost 49 states. And I've heard specifically 1972 brought up dozens of times from older voters over the course of this campaign. Younger voters never bring it up. Of course, some of them may not
have been around during that time,
but may not even know what happened. Some will, but they are much more likely to point to 2016 and say, we don't want a repeat of 2016. We don't want someone who is, you know, successful and experienced but not inspiring. That's what a lot of the younger voters that I talk to are looking for, is someone who gets them fired up. And obviously one thing that both younger and older voters do share is that they watched Vice President Biden standing with Barack Obama, which has been a huge, huge, huge part of that strong support from African-American voters. But I do still get a sense that older African-American voters in South Carolina viewed the symbolism of that, a white establishment politician standing loyally behind a black man for 8 years.
Mm. So while many parts of the rest of the country might take that for granted, that is still very much
absolutely
in the forefront of people's minds here.
You know, this is a state that, of course, has a very dark history when it comes to violence and intimidation at the polls. Particularly older voters who are closer to that lived experience feel very strongly about that.
Will someone like a Representative Clyburn, you think, have a big effect on who people ultimately choose to vote on Saturday?
Well, because of the fact that there are folks who are undecided, I think it could. When I was talking to the congressman on Sunday, he was saying, you know, he was at Bertha's Kitchen in North Charleston just the other day, and there were all these folks coming up to him and saying, we're looking to you for guidance. We're going to do what you do. And that was part of the reason why he decided to get off the sidelines. You know, we are in an age, I think, when endorsements matter less than ever, generally, because everyone has access to information about these candidates. But if anyone in South Carolina was going to have substantial influence on core demographics in this state, it would be Jim Clyburn, a man who does hold significant sway here.
Jamie Lovegrove is a political reporter with the Post and Courier. Jamie, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks, Donnie.
here's one of the many voters we've had the chance to speak with down here in South Carolina.
My name is Stephen J. Likes. I'm from the big town called Swansea, South Carolina. My most important issue is Alzheimer's disease, so I would love it if there's a debate that speaks on healthcare and healthcare only so we can start talking about Alzheimer's. I'm leaning toward Tom Steyer. I'm going to tell you, it's very hard to beat giving black folks a chance at financial independence like he's been doing over the years, no matter if he was with the private prison industry or not with me.
One of the many voices you will hear ahead of the Democratic primary.
More than 1,000 workers in London have been asked to stay home after one of them who traveled through Singapore showed symptoms of COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus. A company in Japan has asked all employees in Tokyo to work from home. Germany's Lufthansa airline is offering employees unpaid leave to try to stem any future economic losses from the virus. Let's talk more about how companies in the U.S. are preparing with Renata Elias, Vice President and Senior Consultant at Marsh Risk Consulting. She's been working with clients on pandemic planning. So, Renata, what are you telling businesses to do to prepare right now?
First of all, I recommend that every organization start looking at putting together a pandemic planning team. This group really should be looking at sort of not only the vulnerabilities that could impact your organization, but also dusting off those plans and procedures. And if you don't have any, look at developing some procedures and plans to be able to respond to a coronavirus outbreak in the U.S.
Well, in fact, many people do have plans from the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s, and they might have those plans from there. But can you be more specific? I mean, these plans about, you know, how many employees can you afford to work from home? Do you have, you know, the software? There's software that enables people to work from home. Check and you see, yes, see if you have the appropriate technology.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So when you're going through these plans, and a lot of these this information will be included in your organization's business continuity plans, is really looking at what are your critical processes. Can individuals work remotely or work from home to be able to conduct those critical processes? Again, organizations need to be looking at that, but also testing to make sure that they are able to work from home.
We understand some businesses do this already. There's one I was reading about in the New York Times. They did a drill almost. Our offices has flooded. Everybody must work from home just to see how it would work.
Absolutely. And that is definitely best practice, to be practicing this so that you know that you're able to handle that influx of folks that will need to work remote from outside of the office.
And what about preparing for the economic fallout? It was interesting to read that Lufthansa is sending some people home now in anticipation of economic issues down the road, not as much to prevent the transfer of the virus.
Yes. And I mean, that's all going to be, and this is why it's really important to have that senior executive leadership involved in making some of these tough decisions. Should we have employees that take an unpaid leave? Should we be giving them a paid leave?
What about protecting the employees you have inside the company from the virus coming in outside of the company? It was interesting to read that Sky Television, the British service, has begun screening visitors at its European offices. And so if somebody's recently traveled to China, they can't come in.
Yes. And this is important. Number one, and an organization's people are their number one asset. So it's really important that organizations take the time to address the people issues, such as keeping your people safe within the workplace. So part of that is looking at things as the proper way to cough, washing your hands. But if you are sick, the whole thing to really get on top of this is really to have people who are sick or who may be exposed to those that are sick to really stay home.
Yeah.
Stay home, self-quarantine, and social distance. If they know they're sick, there is no need to start the social distancing for broadly, but for those that have been exposed or may be exposed.
By the way, we understand that social distancing, in addition to the broad definition, means 6 feet away
with
the people with this virus. But what about a business like a restaurant or a hotel? We just are watching a huge hotel in Spain's Canary Islands on lockdown after an Italian doctor and his partner who visited tested positive. Businesses may have to consider not sending their workers home, but locking everybody in.
And that is something where we really encourage organizations to really adhere to their local health authorities. But yes, hotels, restaurants, they're all needing to at this point be looking at their preparedness plans and, of course, working in conjunction with their local authorities, health authorities.
Well, and these workers who are hands-on, and it was the same on the cruise ships, they're needed. You can't just decide to send half your waitstaff home and still be a restaurant, for instance, as you can send people home, let's say, from a white-collar office. So do insurance policies cover the cost to take care of guests for a long period of time or to, you know, shut down a restaurant because your workers, you know, everybody's been ordered to stay home under quarantine?
I can't really comment on the insurance piece of it. However, that being said, I would really highly encourage all organizations to be reaching out to their insurance broker, their carrier, and asking them those questions.
So what are some of the other points that you want to make for businesses?
The last couple of things, which are really important, look at your business processes. Look at your external dependencies, your supply chain. Identify those areas of vulnerability and then put together some workaround strategies to address each of them. And lastly is really take that senior leadership group and conduct a tabletop exercise now, a hypothetical pandemic scenario. Walk through what a response would look like. Make sure that you identify any gaps that you may have in your planning or preparedness activities now and address them now, because the time is now to get prepared.
Renata Elias, Vice President and Senior Consultant at Marsh Risk Consulting. Renata, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tabletop exercises. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley, broadcasting today from South Carolina Public Radio. This is Here Now.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Outbreaks of the new coronavirus have closed schools in Japan. People have been quarantined in hotels and cruise ships around the world. Some Americans coming home to the U.S. have been forced to remain on military bases. So, what are your legal rights under a government quarantine? That's next time on Here and Now.